So today I wanted to kind of do a detailed report of what we've been kind of touching on, and because there's just been so many things happening, and I want you to be sure you understand where I'm coming from. If you haven't been in this class for a long time, you notice that I've been kind of talking about things happening in the Middle East, and I want you to know why that is. There's been several lessons that we've done in the past that I've explained biblically where we come from, where I come from as far as the teaching on what is happening in the Middle East, why it makes sense, why it's important to us, and I'll touch on that just a little bit today. But there's lessons out on our website that talk about Islam, Christianity in the Middle East, and different things about the Middle East history that if you want to listen to them, great. That gives you a real detailed explanation of where I come from in my teaching. But I want you to know that I want to show you today that the biblical basis for this and why it's important, because there's so many things that we've seen happen just recently. If you'll think back, a year ago in December is whenever the first protest started in Tunisia, a year ago. And just to think what has happened within that year is just incredible, because Tunisia started with these protests that wound up overthrowing their president and government. Okay? So what has happened since then? Well, we showed you this map all along of all of these places that were affected throughout this year. By March of last year, this is how many different countries were affected by protests. Most of these places had their governments overthrown, their presidents or dictators run out, and we are just now seeing who is filling the void. Now then, if you'll remember, I told you early on, because when all this started, of course, the first reaction was, great, you know, freedom and democracy for all these people, finally. And I said, for freedom and democracy to take hold in all these areas is going to take a long time, and it's going to be a hard struggle for that to work out. However, it can go completely horrible overnight. Well, I think we're seeing the outcome of that, and it's not going well. It's not going well. What's happened is, as I said, in all these places, there's this enormous power vacuum. These protesters overthrew governments, but none of them had people to put back into that power position. So there's this enormous void of power. Now we're seeing across North Africa and in the Middle East that militant Islam is taking that power pole in these countries. And I'll show you the outcome of some of this already. So what we're seeing today, I mean, as of today, and I got quotes from this morning that I'm just going, oh no, it's incredible. So why is this important? Why is all this important to us? Number one, because of biblical prophecy and the land of Israel. That, to me, if I can't take any of this back to biblical prophecy, the Word of God, you know, it's just news. However, if we see things playing out that I see as biblical prophecy happening before our eyes, then I know it's important. So number one is Israel and biblical prophecy. Number two, just looking at the political, geopolitical realm of this is fascinating to see the possibilities of what all is going on and how it's playing out. All right? So what I want to do, just to kind of reiterate where I come from on this teaching and why I spend a little bit of time on that and why I wanted to do this today, is we need to start 2,000 years before Christ, 4,000 years ago, and it began with a covenant God made with Abram. And in Genesis 12, he said, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So God makes a covenant with Abraham and promises these things. I'm going to make a great nation out of you, and whoever blesses that nation or curses, I will bless or curse. So I believe with all my heart that how a nation of the world treats the nation of Israel has to do with whether they are blessed or cursed. I believe that stands today. When God makes a covenant, it is everlasting. It doesn't end at any moment in time until it is completely fulfilled in the eternal kingdom. God's still working. He also says that your name will be great, you will be a blessing. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Through Abraham came Ishmael and his descendants. Through Abraham came Isaac and his descendants. Okay? What happened was, Abraham and Hagar had a child, and the angel of the Lord told Hagar, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. So God says, your son, Ishmael, will have descendants too numerous to count. The angel of the Lord also said to her, you are now with child. You will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael. For the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. All right. So if we knew the descendants of Ishmael, would they still carry these same traits today? So, the question is, well then, who are those descendants of Ishmael? Do we have any indication? Yeah, we do. All right, so this is the promise that God said would happen through Ishmael, one of Abraham's sons. Okay, that was a promise that was made. The whole land of Canaan, he promises Abraham, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. So God tells Abraham that I am going to give you, part of my covenant promise is this piece of land that you are now on. And it will be for your descendants and your descendants after them. It will continue. So God makes a covenant with Abraham, and then he says, and my covenant will flow through your other son, Isaac. And then he made the exact same promises, the same covenant promise to Jacob and the descendants of Jacob. So we know Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, which became the 12 tribes of Israel, the modern-day Jewish people. So where did the covenant flow through? The covenant promise that included land flowed through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and to the Jewish people. That's why I believe, as a Christian, biblically, the land of Israel is an everlasting covenant with the Jewish people. It has not ended. All right? Now then, if you look at what happened to Abraham's sons, it says in Genesis 25 that Abram left everything he owned to Isaac, because that was the son of promise, the son of the covenant. While he was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines, which included Ishmael, and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. The land of the east has always meant the land east of the Jordan River. What is the land east of the Jordan River today? Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, all these lands that are east of the Jordan River. Okay? So that's where Abraham sent all of his sons except Isaac. Why did he keep Isaac there? Because there was a covenant, and it had to do with the land that they were standing on that they would possess. Okay? So can we determine the descendants of Ishmael? See, that's the thing. God blessed Ishmael. He told Abraham, he said, don't worry about Ishmael. I'm going to bless him with numerous descendants, and he is going to be the father of a nation also. But he did not make a covenant promise with Ishmael that included a specific land like Israel. But he said, I'm going to bless Ishmael. So what did he do with Ishmael? Well, in Genesis 25, it says, these are the names of the son of Ishmael. Guess what? There's 12 of them. That's interesting. Isaac and Jacob had 12 sons. Ishmael had 12 sons. They were the names of the 12 tribal rulers. Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. His descendants settled in the area from Havilah to Shur, near the border of Egypt, as you go toward Ashur. This is all the peninsula of Saudi Arabia, all the way out to the very end of the Saudi Arabian peninsula. Okay? So where did the descendants of Ishmael wind up? If you track these names and history down, these are today's Arab nations. And as of, you know, 632 AD, mainly Muslim nations with the advent of Muhammad and Islam. Okay? That was 632 AD. So we're looking at 2,600 years after Ishmael. You had the Arab Muslim nations that all claimed descendancy from Father Ishmael. They call Ishmael Father Ishmael. All right? Just as the Jews call Father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob their forefathers. God showed us how it was going to be. Now then, can you look at the descendants of Ishmael and see if God was right? A wild donkey of a man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's against him, and he will live in hostility toward all their brothers? I mean, you know, it's really hard to deny that. It's really hard to deny that, okay? So this is where it began, 2,000 years before Christ, and that's why I believe that these promises have not gone away. God is still dealing with the land of Israel, with his people, the Jews, and he will continue to do that up until the final day, and then for eternity, he cannot break his covenant. Whenever he gives something everlasting, it is everlasting. All right? Is there more? Then if you start looking at biblical prophecy and start adding things up, you start thinking, okay, well, this is what we're seeing today. Zechariah 14, a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half of the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. So, a moment in time when all the nations will be gathered against Israel, against Jerusalem. When has that ever happened?
It's happening now.
It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. So there's a moment in time when all the nations of the world will be gathered against Israel. Okay, so you can start seeing just within this last year how easily that this could come about. And the big question is always, but will the United States ever go against Israel? You know what? I think that can happen very easily too. If the United States is given a choice between oil or supporting Israel, which one do you think we'll take? Especially if we have an administration that is not sympathetic toward Israel. How easily could that fall? Yes, sir? Yep.
What was it? 76
margin of time. We chose. That's right. So far, the United States has been overall a supporter of Israel. Now, we're trying to ride a fence. I mean, it's a really tight fence between, supporting the Arab nations with, this week we signed a deal with United Arab Emirates or Bahrain. For all sorts of military equipment, F-15 fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. We're trying to appease both sides. Now that's kind of a dangerous place to be spiritually. Politically, you think, okay, well, maybe you can play this game for a while. I believe at some point God's going to go, okay, it's time to get off the fence. Make a choice. Make a choice which side you're on. And so, again, will our nation choose to continue to support Israel or not? Now, then the other question that comes up, how, again, would the United States go against Israel? If Israel did something that seemed so heinous in the public eye that the United States backed off and said, well, you know, we can't support that. Which attempts have been made this year to declare the Middle East a nuclear-free zone. And go figure. But if pressure was brought against Israel to finally declare their nuclear status, Israel has practiced nuclear ambiguity. They neither confirm nor deny if they possess any nuclear weapons. But if through world pressure they were brought to say, no, you have to declare, and we have to declare nuclear free, then through the United Nations would the United States be forced to go against Israel to force them into declaring and to do something with their nuclear weapons? I don't know. Yes?
How could we do that? Because we already know that Iran has nuclear stuff in the process of,
yeah,
you know, they're right up to making the bomb.
And as of this morning, Iran has just announced that they put in their first nuclear rod into their reactor, which requires enriched uranium, enriched to the point of nuclear weapons grade. So if what they say is true, then they are at the point of having highly enriched uranium, which could lead to a weapon. So is Iran to the point of owning that, or are they just playing this game, this card, in these negotiations? That can be a very big power play for Iran to do that, whether they've got it or not. I think they're very far along, and number two, they will use it if they have it. And the first missile will go against Israel. I don't doubt that one bit. That's what they've been saying all along.
And the
I believe
will
them.
Be against us.
It, or one of our bases over there. So, okay, so how will all those nations gather against Jerusalem? It's going to happen at some point in time. So there's a prophecy. Another one is out of Joel. In those days and at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all nations. Here's the gathering all nations again. Bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There I will enter into judgment against them concerning what? My inheritance, my people Israel, and for they scattered my people among the nations, and they divided up my land. So God says at some point I'm going to judge all the nations. Based on what? My people Israel, and dividing my land. Whose people and whose land is this that he's concerned about?
Israel.
It's God's. He said, you know, this is what's so powerful is, God says you don't mess with my people or my land. That's mine. And you don't mess with it. You don't divide it. You don't scatter my people, or you will come into judgment. All right? Now then, the people have been scattered for a long time. Those nations have been judged already, and they will continue to be judged. Then who's dividing up their land? Well, this is why I think it's a dangerous thing for us to sit in the United Nations and say, we believe in a two-state solution. That's a dangerous road to walk. It is. Because God says, you're dividing up my land. That belongs to him. And it's everlasting. All right? Then, does this carry over? Jesus carries this over into the New Testament. Whenever he says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. Again, all the nations will be gathered before him. Here it is again. I'm going to gather all the nations before me, and I'm going to do what? He will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He's going to judge the righteous and the unrighteous. And if you want to go back and listen to our whole lesson on the sheep and the goats and all of the interpretations of this, showing that the main interpretation of this is, Jesus, I'm going to judge these nations on how they did what? Whatever you did for the least of these, my brothers, you also did for me. And the goats, whatever you did not do for the least of these, my brothers, you did not do for me. Who are the least of these, his brothers? I think pointedly, he is talking about the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. For us Christians, it's how we treat one another overall. But specifically, he's talking about how you treat the nation of Israel. You're going to come into judgment for that also. Okay, so Jesus carries this over into the New Testament. He also says in Matthew 24, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ and will deceive many. If you just read Matthew 24, there's three or four times in there Jesus says over and over, don't be deceived. There's going to be people coming in my name. They're going to look right. They're going to act right. But they are going to be there to deceive you. Be careful that you are not deceived. Why would Jesus tell that to us? Who was this meant for? Who was this warning meant for?
It was meant for all of us.
He gave it to all believers. This is for us. We are to look for signs. We are to be ready. We are to be watchful. We are to watch out. We are to study. We are to be full of God's wisdom and His Word so we will not be deceived. And then he goes on to say, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places, even Oklahoma. All these are the beginning of the birth pains. Okay, so again, people have looked at this and say, oh, this has been happening for years. Every generation, they could match this. There's a lot of things going on right now that haven't happened for 2,000 years. Yes?
More and more earthquakes and more different places.
Yeah.
More vast famines. There are diseases. The intensity of storms. There are diseases that we've never seen before.
Things seem to be happening more frequently and with greater intensity. Is this the beginning of the birth pains? Could be. We don't know. Could it be another 40 years? Could it be another 400 years? Yeah, it could. The important thing is Jesus told us, be wary, watch out that no one deceives you. Look for these signs and be prepared. So there's a lot of things that are going on, and this is not, none of this is out of putting people into fear. Again, we have the Word of God. We know who's in control. We know the outcome. But in the meantime, he tells us, be on guard, be on watch. Don't be deceived and carried away by false teachers, doctrine, all of these things. Be careful. Yes?
What I hear from a lot of people is they're really afraid. You know, 2020, really afraid. And the rumors of wars and all these other things, they want a leader. We don't need a leader. We have one. Yep. He's up there on
the throne. He's on the throne and he's still in charge.
Right.
But But she brings up a good point, and what she's saying is people are afraid and they want a leader. You know, the big question is, people are always, I've been asked a dozen times, how could the world fall for a single person, the Antichrist? How could they do that? There it is right there. You inject enough fear and turmoil and economy and all of these things going on. People, we want a leader to fix this. And at some point there's going to be a leader that stands up and says, I'll take care of all of this. And people are going to flock to that person. And that's why Jesus says, be on your guard. Watch out that no one deceives you. Many are going to come in my name. That's not the one. Be careful. That's why he gave us the warnings. Okay? Does it continue? Well, let's look at the things that have happened just the last few weeks. I mean, this is pretty powerful. Okay, so what does this area look like? If you have a restraining force called the U.S. military in the land of Iraq, and they pull out on December 18th, 4 days later, December 22nd, 12 blasts killing 69 people and injuring hundreds in Baghdad. Okay, my question is, if you have a restraining force of U.S. military, and for the last several years there's been a lot of sectarian violence between the Sunnis and the Shiites and a lot going on, what happens when you take that force completely out of there? I think that this was a signal of what it's going to be like. Okay? The Sunnis and the Shiites, for just to reiterate, the battle in Islam began in 632 AD. Muhammad died, not leaving a successor. So the argument began immediately. The successor of Islam, the leader of Islam, should be a blood relative of Muhammad. Those are the Shiites. The Sunnis said, no, the leader of Islam should just observe the traditions and teachings of Muhammad. So they've been at war with each other for 1,400 years, the Sunnis and the Shiites. What was happening in Iraq was, Iraq and Iran are Shiite majority. Under Saddam Hussein, the Shiite majority was ruled by the Sunni minority. Drove them nuts. So, with a little free rein, they start attacking each other because they want to get rid of the Sunnis mainly. And so the Shiite, that's what the whole Iraq-Iran war was about. It was Shiite versus Sunni. Okay? So now then, that the government is trying to coalesce, even the government leaders in Iraq, they've got a Sunni and Shia out for each other already. And it's getting crazy. Okay? So the question is, will Iran take this opportunity of an open window to go back into Iraq to support their Shiite members? Don't know. But you can see this tension. Folks, they believe that this is a religious war. We may not voice it. We may not say it out loud. But if we don't understand it from their viewpoint that this is a religious war, then we're fighting it wrong. And we've been kind of fighting it wrong for several years, and it's sad. But to them, it's a religious war. Okay? What else? Well, even through today, Syria, total genocide continues at the hands of Bashar Assad's military. Over 5,000 dead now, even with Arab monitors in place. Arab monitors are in place in Syria as of Thursday, I believe. And he was still killing people right in front of the Arab monitors. Mm-hmm. The guy's nuts. The guy's nuts. Okay, what's it in Syria? Syria, this is really gets wacky. Syria is a Sunni majority country. Shiite minority. A smaller minority are the Alawites. The Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam. And the Shiites see the Alawites as heretics. Well, guess who the Alawites are in Syria? The entire Assad family and his government are the Alawites. That's the way it's been for several decades. So the Sunni majority is being run by this little tiny clan of Alawites. And even the Shiites hate the Alawites. I mean, but the Assad government has all the power. They've got the military. So how do they handle situations? They just go kill them. They just go kill them. So that's why you're seeing this worked out today, again. Now then, the thing you need to remember, Syria supports financially and militarily Hezbollah, which is mainly stationed in Lebanon with the specific purpose of eliminating Israel. Hezbollah, the party of God, party of Allah, that is their intent, is to create the elimination of Israel. That's Hezbollah, supported by Syria. Okay? What else? Well, how about Muslim violence against Christians? Christmas Day in Nigeria, Muslim groups bomb churches during church services, killing dozens. A year ago today is when several Coptic churches, Egyptian Coptic Christian churches in Alexandria, Egypt, were bombed, killing a lot of Christians. My point is, in this environment, it's going to continue to get worse and worse if you're a Christian in any of these countries. With no power to control, to keep a handle on all this, it will be increasingly difficult for Christians to operate at all, to worship at all. Most of them will leave the countries. Some of them will be killed in violence, as we continue to see. In all of these territories, that's what's going to be happening with the Christians. It is not going to be good for Christianity in any of these countries. It'll continue to get worse. Okay? What else? Well, how about Egypt, the most populous Muslim nation? A lot of people say, as Egypt goes, so goes all the Arab world. And to a large extent, that's true. So after the second round of elections, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis, the Al-Nur party, which is the fundamentalist Islamic sect, now control two-thirds of parliament. They have one more round of elections to go here in the next couple weeks, and this will increase. They will have more positions in parliament in the Egyptian government. Okay? So what do you think about the future of Egypt? Remember, we said, you know, freedom and democracy, not with the Muslim Brotherhood and fundamentalist Islamic sect of the Salafis. That can't happen. That's not going to happen. But yet, that's how it's worked out in Egypt. Okay? So, again, there's another round of elections coming up, and I think that they will own more of parliament after they get through. So who is the Muslim Brotherhood, and who is the Al-Nur party, the Salafis? Who, like, what do they believe, what do they say in public? Let's look at Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood, they want a modern democratic state based on Sharia law. How do you have modern democracy based on Sharia law? That's an oxymoron. That just doesn't work. It's not going to work. What they will say is, we were elected democratically. That's true. So was Hamas. They were elected democratically. After that point, they basically say, we'll take it from here. And they will take it from there, and it'll get worse. They are going to have, this is all direct statements out of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, their Freedom and Justice Party. That's a great euphemism. Their legislation will be based on the principles of Sharia. They say that followers of other religions would be governed by their own laws on religious matters. They say that, but any Islamic country, just look at the history. That's not the way it turns out. They say that, we believe in freedom and openness and religion for everyone. So,
as long as you follow them. Right?
And so what happens is that it's a matter of, well, let me give you this. I cannot draft a law. This is their Secretary General. I cannot draft a law that says an unveiled woman will be forbidden from this or that. But I must make her feel that her punishment is in the afterlife. Okay, now then, who would be an unveiled woman in Egypt? For Christians. And people who don't want to follow strict Islamic law. Well, okay, so if you have the freedom to operate religiously and you don't want to wear a veil, then how is he going to make your punishment be felt in the afterlife? See, what happens is all these people in all these Islamic countries, they wind up having to follow the Islamic law because you can't go out in public without a veil. That's not allowed. In Saudi Arabia, women, you can't drive a car. You know, I saw a little cartoon in Saudi Arabia. They said, well, you know, in the next elections, women are going to have the right to vote. But they're going to have to show their driver's license as ID. Women can't drive in Saudi Arabia. Okay.
There's an interesting paradox in that. If you're supposed to follow your law, and your law says that you condemn the people that are, quote, infidels or heretics.
Exactly.
It's kind of an interesting paradox if you start thinking through that.
And so, under true Sharia law says that any non-Muslim living in a Muslim land must pay the jizya, or tax, because you're not a Muslim. So, you can live here, you can operate, if you pay the tax. So you're called a dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. So if you're a non-Muslim living in a Muslim land, you're a dhimmi. And you pay a dhimmi tax. So that's how they can kind of manage you. But you still can't go out without a veil. You still cannot, you know, you just can't operate. Okay, that's the way it works out. All right, so the next thing I want to do is gradually expand Islamic banking into Egypt. Mainly Islamic banking means that you do not charge interest to Muslims. Okay? Now then, how they get around that? If you want a loan for $5,000, we'll make the loan for $6,000. You got to pay us back $6,000, but that's not interest. That's how it's done. So that way they do not charge a Muslim, fellow Muslim, interest. That's Islamic banking. And it will continue to grow. The Muslim Brotherhood is a vociferous critic of the Zionist entity, Israel. And out of Muslim Brotherhood came Hamas, the militant arm that is sworn to the elimination of Israel. Okay, so now you got Hezbollah on the north, Hamas on the south. There you go. Got the pinchers in effect. Okay, as of this morning, here you go. This is the Muslim Brotherhood. This morning, the deputy leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, when asked whether it is a requirement for the government in Egypt to recognize Israel, he responded by saying, this is not an option. Whatever the circumstances, we do not recognize Israel at all. It is an occupying criminal enemy. What have we been told by our State Department in the last few months? Muslim Brotherhood, the State Department has asked Muslim Brotherhood, will you still honor the Israeli peace treaty? Oh, of course. The State Department tells us, don't worry about it. You don't need to worry about the Muslim Brotherhood. They're going to honor peace treaties. This is their deputy leader as of this morning. The deputy leader stressed during the interview that no Muslim Brotherhood members would ever meet with Israelis for negotiations. I will not allow myself to sit down with criminals. He went on to say that the Muslim Brotherhood would take legal procedures toward canceling the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel that was signed in 79. The Brotherhood respects international conventions, but we will take legal action against the peace treaty with the Zionist entity. How is that going to sit well with the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel? It's about to come to an end, folks. It's not going to be good. All right, so that's the Muslim Brotherhood. They have 42% of parliament. Okay? The other 24%, here's another Muslim Brotherhood front. You know, they are the ones that spawned Hamas. Just last week, the leader of Hamas said, the Islamic resistance movement of Hamas, by definition, is a jihadist movement by the Muslim Brotherhood. Palestinian on the surface, Islamic at its core, and its goal is liberation. Liberation of what?
Israel.
Palestine, the land of Israel. That's Hamas's intent. They are an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what their leader states in public. Why do we believe anything? Why do we want to go to negotiations with any of these people? This is what they state in public. All right? All right, so this is the Muslim Brotherhood, 42% of the new parliament. The Salafis, the Al-Nur party, they see themselves as a purer alternative to other Islamist parties. They see the Muslim Brotherhood as a little bit too liberal. They do. They really do. They spurn democracy. Here you go. You want freedom and democracy? No, they really don't. The Al-Nur party says democracy is man's law over Allah's law. We don't want democracy. They see themselves as the guardians of Sharia law. Women and Christians will not be able to run for president. Remember that little religious freedom deal that we just... how that's going to work. The legal system punishes according to Islamic law. Islam must resist democracy. These are statements from the leaders of the Salafi sect in Egypt that has about a fourth of their parliament. They will segregate sexes, ban usury or interest, just like the Islamic banking. They will cut off the hands of thieves. They will have, this is what Sharia law runs to. Okay, so here's two-thirds of the Egyptian parliament. Here you go. So, again, it can go horrible overnight, and that's what's happening. Okay? This is Egypt. You see why I worry about poor little Israel. Another statement from Al-Nur, Egypt's Salafi party announces it will honor the Israeli peace treaty so as not to violate international agreements, but stresses it will work to amend clauses which exploit us. Guess how many clauses in there that they feel exploit the nation of Egypt? Pretty much all of it. So what they're doing is saying, telling the world, oh yeah, we'll honor it. Except for these parts here, we're going to have to look at those. And so you combine those with the Muslim Brotherhood says, we're not going to negotiate with Israel at all. You put those two together, it's not going to be good. Okay? It won't be good. All right, where does all this start? Well, here's an example. Just kind of, you know, you think, well, how does all this get started? In Saudi textbooks, 10th and 9th graders, says the teenagers are taught barbaric practices. They show students how to cut the hand and feet off of a thief. Well, that's right out of the Quran. So all they're doing is teaching what the Quran teaches to 10th graders. And how about the 9th graders? Taught the annihilation of the Jewish people, it is imperative. One text reads in part, the hour of judgment will not come until the Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. There's a Jew behind me, come and kill him. That's right out of the Hadith. All right? So you have 9th and 10th graders being taught from their textbooks in Saudi Arabia, this is your attitude toward the nation of Israel, and here is Sharia law. This is where it starts. This is why all these countries in this whole area are in such peril because Islamic law is going to be taken over. That's the danger to this area. That's the danger to Israel. That's the danger to the rest of the world. It's going horrible. It's going horrible overnight. All right, that's where it comes from. Now then, the last thing that I want to show you here is the geopolitical. What happens geopolitically here? Well, by the way, like I say, Iran just announced this morning that they inserted their first fuel rod into their nuclear reactor. So the big question, like she says, is does Iran have the capability of creating a nuclear warhead? All indications are that they are right up to the very edge of that. They are enriching uranium higher and higher efficiencies. If they have enriched uranium enough for a nuclear fuel rod for a reactor, then they are very close to having that weapon-grade uranium, or I don't know if they got plutonium or not, for a nuclear weapon. Then they need to work on the delivery system. Just this last week, they said during this standoff with the Strait of Hormuz that they were going to launch a long-range missile. It's all there. It's all just stacking into place. All right, so if you look at the possibilities here, and what's happening is, all this week you've heard in the news that Iran is threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz. So what you have here is the Persian Gulf, and here is the Strait of Hormuz, right there. It's only about 30 miles wide, and up to 40% of the world's crude oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. It's coming out of Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and it's flowing through the Strait of Hormuz. So again, Iran is saying, well, if you mess with us, we'll just close the Strait of Hormuz. We'll mine it, we'll do stuff to where it'll close, and you'll shut off your oil. The flip side of that is, well, that's going to hurt Iran also. Okay? So some of the economic sanctions are being put in place today, as of today, are that we are trying to encourage nations not to buy crude oil or anything from Iran to hurt them economically. So at some point, will Iran say, well, if we're hurt this bad already, then we might as well go ahead and jump off, close the Strait of Hormuz, because we're hurting already, so we can make a statement. Well, if that happens, the U.S. Navy 5th Fleet operates out of Bahrain, which is inside the Persian Gulf. They will attack any Iranian vessels or whatever they're doing to close the Strait of Hormuz, and then does that escalate into a big battle? We don't know. Okay, so the question is, well, if they close the Strait of Hormuz, well, that takes care of the east coast of Saudi Arabia. Well, we can still get oil out the west coast, can't we? And so along the Red Sea here is the whole west coast of Saudi Arabia, and that oil flows through the Gate of Tears. Here sits Yemen in charge of the Gate of Tears. Who's in charge in Yemen right now? Ain't nobody in charge in Yemen right now. What happened to the president of Yemen? Huh? Yeah, he's trying to get in the United States for medical procedures, because he's been thrown out. His son is trying to take charge of the military in Yemen to keep it under control, but effectively the Yemen president is gone. So the United States is determining, do we let him under medical need, but then he's going to stay here and we don't want him here, all this kind of stuff. So who's in charge in Yemen? Who's the biggest power in Yemen? Huh? Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is in charge in Yemen. So what do you think one of the first things they'll do? Well, let's close the Gate of Tears. Okay? Well, wait a minute. There's still another outlet. You can go up the other end of the Red Sea to the Suez Canal. Who's in charge of the Suez Canal?
Egypt.
The Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis. There you go, folks. And so the possibilities are that the entire Arabian Peninsula output of crude oil could be halted. That's geopolitical type stuff that feeds into the spiritual. All of this, we don't know. I mean, if those things actually happen, it would be pretty phenomenal, because it would hurt all those nations. But are they willing to do that? Are they willing to put the United States to the test to get off the fence? You want to support the Arabs or you want to support the Jews? Yes?
With all of this in place, And with the opportunities that we're supposed to have with Canada and all that,
yeah,
make the pipeline there, why are we not doing that?
I agree.
Rather than go through all of this.
Drill, baby, drill. Yeah, I mean, all those questions come up about if we have the resources, and we're finding more and more with the shale formations, the sands formations, drilling in the Gulf, that's the questions that come out of this. And you know, there's not easy answers, but most of them you're going, logically, we need to be doing this. We need to be getting rid of this dependence. But I want you to see how all this fits in biblically. It does. You look at all of this and stuff and say, oh, it's so complex, it could never fit together. Yes, it could. And it can fit together very easily. That's my point. So what does Jesus say? Be watchful so no one deceives you. All of this may take another 400 years. We don't know. The point is, we know our God. We know He's in control. We know where our salvation is. We don't have to worry about this, but we need to be watchful so that we are not deceived. Okay? Why did Jesus give us those signs? For us. They're for us. Okay? All right, any more questions? Yes?
I had one. You know, we talked about this one world leader.
Yes.
Yep. It has a lot of reasons why.
And there's incredible reasons why the Islamic Messiah could be our Antichrist. I mean, there's a lot of great evidence. And again, if I've shown you his quotes before, but the president of Iran, when he stands up in front of the United Nations with a world platform and calls for the coming of the 12th Imam, you know, that is incredible. People don't realize what that means on the spiritual realm, the political realm, the economic realm. People don't realize what that means. That's why we need to be watchful. So back to what she's saying is, there's a lot of evidence that the Islamic Messiah is the biblical Antichrist. So then why would Jesus say, many people will come in my name. Many people will say, there's the Christ, there's the Messiah, there he is. Don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. It makes a lot of sense when you look at it that way. We don't know, but there's a lot to that. And if you have Islamic nations at the upper echelons stating that they're looking for the 12th Imam to come in into this world turmoil, And they're creating the world turmoil to usher into the age of the Islamic Messiah, I think that we need to pay attention to that. I think Ahmadinejad will do what he says. I really do. So, yep, one more.
The thing I'm most worried about is, I know that God's in control, so he's got everything planned, but I still feel that we need to have a president in office that will support Israel. And as we have right now, that's not so.
So far, I think what has helped a lot is that we've had a Congress that is still very supportive of Israel. And I think that that's helped a lot. A whole leadership that is supportive of Israel would certainly be a healthy thing in these times. All right. Let's have a word of prayer. Almighty God, we thank you so much that you are on the throne, that you are God over all. We thank you that through your Son, Jesus Christ, we have assurance of salvation and hope for eternity. And we know that you keep your promises, you keep your covenants, especially through the blood of your Son. We thank you for that assurance. God, throughout all of this, we just ask that we give your wisdom and your perspective to all that come in contact with us. God, show us who we need to be witnesses to for your glory, for your Son. We look forward to serving you in your kingdom in whatever capacity that you have us serve in. God, I thank you for this class and the lives that they've touched this last year, letting you work through them. In your Son's name, amen. Thank y'all.